This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are we on the road to mass extinction? More scientists from different fields of study say it is possible as we pollute the atmosphere and the oceans. We'll explore that, the worst-case scenario, in this edition of Radio EcoShock. I'm going to dedicate this program to one such scientist, Dr. Andrew Glickson, an Earth and Paleoclimate Specialist from Australian National University. We featured Andrew Glickson in our Radio EcoShock show May 1st, 2009. You can download that free from our website, ecoshock.org. We'll also interview a top scientist from Yale, Dr. Mark Pagani. His recently released study shows a hot greenhouse world just 5 million years ago with CO2 levels similar to those we already put into the atmosphere. We'll talk about what the IPCC may have missed. And we'll keep coming back to the mother of all climate nightmares, the dying oceans, which could wipe out most land species as well, including us. You'll hear clips from an important speech, Brave New Oceans, by Jeremy Jackson, Scripps Professor of Oceanography. He too warns we are heading towards a mass extinction event, and Jackson is far from alone. But first, we'll start with a droplet of good news. Bill Gates, the world's richest man, has finally discovered dangerous climate change. Here is how Gates began his speech to TED, the Technology, Entertainment, and Design series, on February 12, 2010.
I'm going to talk today about energy and climate. And that might seem a bit surprising because my full-time work at the foundation is mostly about vaccines and seeds, about the things that we need to invent and deliver to help the poorest 2 billion live better lives. But energy and climate are extremely important to these people. In fact, more important than to anyone else on the planet. The climate getting worse means that many years, their crops won't grow. There'll be too much rain, not enough rain. Things will change in ways that their fragile environment simply can't support. And that leads to starvation. It leads to uncertainty. It leads to unrest. So the climate changes will be terrible for them. I asked the top scientists on this several times, do we really have to get down to near zero? Can't we just, you know, cut it in half or a quarter? And the answer is that until we get near to zero, the temperature will continue to rise. And so that's a big challenge. It's very different than saying, you know, we're a 12-foot high truck trying to get under a 10-foot bridge and we can just sort of squeeze under. This is something that has to get to zero.
You can find the whole video presentation by Bill Gates at TED.com, and I've posted the audio on my website for those who prefer an MP3 to go. Gates describes a formula for attacking greenhouse gas emissions. It is remarkable that he endorses zero CO2 emissions by 2050, not reductions, zero. After noting the unsolved difficulties of capturing CO2 and trying to store it for hundreds or thousands of years, Bill Gates recommended a new type of nuclear reactor. Not surprising from the master monopolist, he briefly describes a nuclear tech he owns called TerraPower. I may go into that in a future show. The point is, one by one, even the billionaires are getting the scientific warnings about peak oil and about a dangerous climate shift. Welcome aboard, Bill. Now let's get on to the scientists who warn us the very worst could happen. Five times in the life history of our planet, mass extinctions have slashed through the species. In the worst, the Permian extinction of 250 million years ago, around 80 to 90% of all ocean species, and 75% of those on the land, plants and animals, vanished. We need to know why, and we need to know if that is developing now due to our actions. One of the most persistent voices is Andrew Glickson. Andrew arrived in Australia as a war orphan from Germany many years ago. Perhaps that enabled him to separate himself a bit, to view the long-term history of life, as recorded in the ancient stones of Australia. He began with the record of outer space impacts, like asteroids hitting the Earth. But Glickson early recognized that space forces did not cause all the dead zones in the rock record. He began to specialize in climate changes as the grim reaper of species. Then he saw clearly, as we are creating, the conditions for our own demise.
We are living in an ice age. Mammoths would not, warm-blooded mammoths would have hardly been able to exist on the land if conditions were as warm as in the Cretaceous, although there were some mammals in the Cretaceous, mostly burrowing underground.
I got Andrew's new papers as they come out. I read them, and I resisted them. The message is clear, and it's frightening. We humans developed in the rotation of ice ages, with air and ocean currents driven by the difference between the frozen poles and the hot tropics. If the poles melt, weather systems change beyond our agricultural possibilities, and oceans stagnate. Without ocean mixing, oxygen drops in the seas. Then, as Dr. Peter Ward has described twice on Radio EcoShock, other microbes take over. Those life forms don't need oxygen, and they emit hydrogen sulfide, a gas deadly to all oxygen breathers, including those of us on land. Mass extinctions follow. Could it happen again in this lovely world? We can't believe it. We are programmed to believe in the ways we have always known. So it takes many trips into this looming void before the pieces get personal, before we know the truth in our hearts. For me, this round began a month ago when Dr. Glickson sent me a paper about rising seas and climate skeptics. In it, he said that our current CO2 levels of 388 parts per million already commits us to 3 or 4 degrees of heating in the tropics and 10 degrees in the polar regions. Never mind what emissions may come in 2100 or 2050, the greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere will drive us beyond the tipping point. How could he say this? On what authority? I looked for the footnote and found a reference to a recent study by Dr. Mark Pagani of Yale, so I phoned Dr. Pagani to find out more. Here is some important news. It is possible planet Earth could get much hotter, even at our current levels of CO2. That's from startling new research about the climate sensitivity to changes in our atmosphere. Here to explain is that paper's lead author, Dr. Mark Pagani from the Yale Department of Geology and Geophysics. Mark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, thank you.
I hate to start with conclusions, but why should our listeners care about the implications of your latest paper?
Well, climate sensitivity is what everyone is really talking about when it comes to the climate debate. What we want to know is the temperature change for a given CO2 change of the Earth. And so when we talk about climate change, and if we talk about future temperature change, most people refer to climate sensitivity estimates that are based on mostly model estimates, coupled models, and their results. These estimates range between about 1.5 degrees to about 4.5 degrees per CO2 doubling. And so we speak of climate sensitivity in reference to CO2 in terms of CO2 doubling, because every CO2 doubling gives you approximately the same temperature change. So ultimately what we're interested in is understanding the response of Earth's temperature to a given doubling of CO2.
Now, can you explain the factors that could add to global heating that perhaps the IPCC did not address?
Ultimately, there's a range of temperature that is predicted for a given CO2 change. The range is between about 1.5 to 4.5, and that's the highest probability as determined by these climate models. As well, and using some empirical data, obviously, in things like where they look at the way temperature changes over a volcanic eruption or looking at the temperature change over the last century and things like that. They're modeling using observations. But the range is uncertain. The highest probability is between 1.5 to 4.5. But there are higher values in both model estimates and empirical data that most people don't really talk about. There are estimates that are quite higher than 4.5 degrees Celsius for a given doubling. And all of this climate sensitivity is a result of what we call feedbacks. The actual temperature change that CO2 is responsible for is predicted to be rather small. So you have some small temperature change because you've increased CO2. But then when you change the temperature of the Earth, you increase the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, for example. That's a fast feedback. And water vapor is a greenhouse gas. And so that warms the planet even more. And if you warm the planet a little bit, you also may increase the emissions of, let's say, methane. and methane's a greenhouse gas, and so you will increase methane production and the rate of methane input, and so that you'll increase the concentration of methane in the atmosphere, and so you have a feedback that also enhances warming. And then you might melt back sea ice. And sea ice and any type of ice is like a big mirror that reflects sunlight. And if you take away these mirrors, then you increase the amount of sunlight that is absorbed by the ocean and the land, and that increases the temperature of the Earth as well. So these are positive feedbacks with a little bit of warming due to CO2, which ultimately enhances the temperature change of the planet. So those are the effects that most people are talking about in these short timescales. And when I say short timescales, I mean decadal timescales over tens of years. We would imagine these sort of changes driving the temperature to change within about 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius. I should also add that a legitimate climate skeptic, as you know, as people refer to them, they have a legitimate argument if they're arguing within the uncertainty of these estimates. If they choose to argue for a 1.5 degree or 1 degree, or about, let's say, 1 degree Celsius change in temperature, it's within the uncertainty of our estimates. And it suggests, if you take that standpoint, that there's very little temperature change for a given CO2 doubling. But if the evidence is leaning towards much higher temperature change per CO2 doubling, well, then that's potentially, there's big changes afoot in terms of environmental change for, let's say, a 4.5 degree temperature change. That's really large, you know. 4.5 is very large.
And you did set out to explore a period around 4 or 4.5 million years ago when the Earth was much hotter than today. What was that world like?
Yeah, so a good time to look at the effects of relationships between CO2 and climate would be this time period known as the early Pliocene, which is only about 5 million years ago. It sounds like a long time, but you know, for geologists, it's just almost like today. Land masses and continental positions were about the same. There was ice on the planet on both poles, but not substantial ice in the northern hemisphere. Most of the ice is in the southern hemisphere. And it's a much warmer world. The mean annual temperature is about 4 degrees warmer than today, 4 degrees C. And I just want to emphasize that's a lot. The mean temperature difference between today, for example, and the last glacial maximum when, you know, during the height of the last ice age, well, that's only about 5 degrees difference. You know, so 5 degrees is a lot. And so we have about a 4-degree temperature change. There was a lot. It was broadly warm. There's evidence for much higher sea levels and reduced ice in the northern hemisphere. In fact, northern hemisphere glaciation isn't triggered until about, I believe, we're moving into about 2.5 million years ago. So we see sort of an ice-free or very low ice volume northern hemisphere back then as well.
And you managed to measure or attempt to measure the CO2 levels from millions of years ago at that time. And I read your paper. It isn't easy going without a science degree, but I made it by looking up a fair amount about tiny sea life called phytoplankton. So how did you measure those CO2 levels from that period?
All right. Well, this work calculates or estimates CO2 by looking at the chemical properties of molecules that come from particular algae. And you can think of algae like, it's like a plant. I mean, it's a photosynthetic organism, so it's like, you can think of it like a plant. And the chemistry of its carbon is dependent on CO2 concentrations. It's the easiest way to understand it without getting into much more detail. And so we're able to measure the chemistry of this carbon, and through a particular model, we're able to define estimates or constrain estimates for CO2. Now, there are other methods to do this, and all the methods pretty much agree. So I'll just say that they're distinctly different methods, and sometimes they do agree and sometimes they don't in the geologic history. But during this time, they all agree. It's not that long ago, and the techniques are fairly well calibrated. So all these techniques show that CO2 was about 400 parts per million, or ppm. And today's value is about 385. And there's a range of estimates between around 400. I say 400 as an average value, but there's a plus or minus of about probably 20 or 30 ppm.
Well, you know, Dr. Hansen, when he came out and from NASA and said that 350 parts might be the safe level or even less than that. It seemed a little far out, but it seems like your research is almost saying that could be correct.
Well, when Jim Hansen talks about levels like 350, he's just really concerned with the way the world is today and how much change a society could potentially handle. And he would argue that 350 is a safe value in the sense that when temperatures finally stabilize, if you were to stop at 350, then they would be low enough to maintain a reasonable amount of ice volume and sea level change and distinct changes in, let's say, the hydrologic or the water cycle of the world, both globally and regionally. So that's why he shoots for lower numbers. What we're seeing in the of today, of course, is that the value of CO2 today is 385 or something like that. It goes up 2 ppm every year now. And what the geologic record is telling us, which is, you know, basically an historical record, is that it was much warmer when CO2 was about what it is today. So we would imagine that if we stop right now, or if we increase a little bit more, and we let the world stabilize over the long run, not over a couple of years, not over tens of years, maybe over hundreds of years, we would find the temperature of the Earth would increase by as much as 4 degrees. So 4 degrees, as I say, is a very high number. It's 4 degrees globally. So we would imagine that the low latitudes feels about 4 degrees, but high latitudes feel much, much warmer temperatures. So a lot of the warming is going on in the high latitudes, which promotes melting, and melting promotes sea level rise. And we're talking about a lot of sea level rise here. We're not talking about small fry stuff. You know, we're talking about having about 21 vertical feet of sea level caught up in Greenland. We have like 210 vertical feet of sea level caught up on Antarctica, vertical feet. So that's a tremendous amount of sort of lateral incursion of the sea with those dimensions vertically.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Mark Pagani of Yale. We're looking into what the Earth's past can tell us about dramatic climate change. Mark, isn't there a problem when we try to apply geological timescales to human affairs? As I understand it, you're studying changes that take place over perhaps 500,000 years or more. Does that really say much about our situation now?
Yeah, that's a good question. The paper we're talking about, this is a geological experiment, but it does have some, it does reflect on our modern situation. What we're trying to understand when we are discussing climate issues, future climate change, and how society will respond to it, what we try to understand are the feedbacks in the system that promote change. And the debate on human timescales tends to focus on these what we call fast feedback effects. These are fast things that happen, and they happen over a decadal or, let's say, over the century. And that's a great concern. But there are slow feedbacks that are also occurring at different rates. That's why they call them slow. But they're occurring at the same time that appear to promote even further climate change. So there are factors in the Earth system that keep driving the system towards, at least in this case, towards warmer temperatures. When we warm it a little, we get a lot of warming. And so the geologic record tells us there's a lot of warming in the positive direction with small changes in CO2. When you look at the last few years or decades and a few ppm, and that's what all the discussion has all been about, it's very difficult to tease out the direction and the magnitude of change that we would see. So someone could argue on the basis of very small changes in CO2 and very small changes in temperature that we have very little to worry about because it looks like there's a very small climate or low climate sensitivity to CO2 change. The geologic record tells us differently. The geologic record tells us that the lower end of the climate sensitivity range in terms of our estimates are probably wrong, and the value is probably closer to about 3 or higher in terms of what we should expect in terms of both fast feedback climate sensitivity and long-term. The middle-of-the-road climate sensitivity value of 3 is probably what I would argue is correct, but the high end for the long-term estimates of climate sensitivity are as high as 6 to 7 degrees per CO2 doubling. That's what the geologic record is telling us for this most recent period of warming.
So if I understand you correctly, it's possible from what we've learned from the Pliocene period that even if we manage to transfer out of burning fossil fuels to some new technologies, that 200, 300, 400 years from now, the heating might continue and the world might be drastically changed.
Right. The only way to avoid this sort of thing is to extract the CO2 from the atmosphere. So that would be the key. And keep in mind also, there's another dynamic here that's important, is that, you know, most of the Earth is the ocean, right? 70% of the Earth is ocean. And it's a deep, cold ocean. And that tends to buffer temperature changes because the ocean is absorbing the heat. Once the ability of the ocean to absorb heat attenuates, then we're going to see much greater warming. And if we allow the oceans to warm and then decide to extract the CO2, the oceans will release its heat. And the estimates and the models that I've seen predict that about the same heat is released as captured by CO2. So even if you remove the CO2 after, let's say, a century of warming, you'll have several centuries of heat release that are equivalent to the CO2 that was trapping the heat in the first place.
So we've changed the world.
Well, sure.
Wow. So if the climate is more sensitive to greenhouse gases than we thought, even 5 years ago, how would you advise top politicians?
I'm not in the business of advising people.
You do the science and leave that to them.
Yeah, I'll let them handle their business and let me handle mine.
Okay, we're talking with Yale's Mark Pagani. Frankly, your paper is a little frightening to me. We're changing the atmosphere. It's more sensitive than we thought. What should the general public take home from this research?
I guess there's some confusion over the role that greenhouse gases and CO2 play in altering the temperature of the Earth. As though, like, it doesn't have any effect. I hear this sort of thing, and it's always so peculiar. It tends to be in the political realm, but it works its way down into average people, right? So I think the message that you take away from this is that, let's say, the atmosphere is important. The atmosphere increases the temperature of the Earth. If you don't believe that, then go live on the moon for one night and see how cold it gets. The atmosphere maintains the temperature of the Earth about 30 degrees Celsius warmer than it would be if it didn't have an atmosphere. And that CO2, at least from the perspective of the geologic record, has a tremendous capacity to change the temperature of the Earth. And we have a long way of going before the CO2 is anywhere near saturated and stops having this capacity. So there is a direct sort of first-order correlation between temperature change of the Earth and CO2 concentrations, as we see it in the geologic record. It's the first order control on the temperature of the Earth. And by increasing CO2, you will have to, and you will effectively change the temperature of the Earth, and all things that follow with temperature will be altered, including sea level, the amount of ice, ecosystems, where diseases propagate, how the vectors of diseases, if they're mosquito-borne, because this is correlated to both temperature and water, and the hydrologic cycle will be affected. So all these things that we've built our society around will be impacted. And if we're happy to live with those changes, some of these will be extreme, then that's what we'll do. And if you're not happy to live with those changes, and you think the consequences are too grave, then you should stop increasing CO2 concentration.
And in your earlier research, you found Earth can reach real extremes like a tropical North Pole.
Well, tropical is probably the wrong word, but the North Pole was as warm as, let's say, on average as Miami, 50 million years ago. And 50 million years ago, the sun was actually a little cooler because the evolution of stars, they actually warm through time. So 50 million years ago, the sun was a little cooler, but the Earth was much, much, much warmer. There was no ice on either of the poles, and temperature estimates for the North Pole were as high as about 19 to 20 degrees C on average. No freezing winters, and about 5 million years later after that study, you're referring to the height of the Eocene warming, or what they call the height of the Eocene warming 50 million years ago. There were looks like there's evidence for palm trees in the Arctic and the alligators. So, it was a different world. I mean, the world can become very warm. This is not something that surprises people who study the Earth's history. But when we think about the future, we tend to think about this as the great leap backwards, because most of the time Earth was ice-free.
Mark, where do you go from here? What will you work on next?
I'm interested in the hydrologic cycle under global warming. So we're trying to reconstruct how the hydrologic cycle, both regionally or hemispherically, perhaps globally, is altered under warmer temperatures. You know, the big questions would be, what happens to the water cycle in the mid-latitudes where we live, you know, where the bread basket of the world resides? You know, does it become drier? Is it wetter? Is it, you know, that would be some of the big questions like that we'd like to answer. And how does the transport of vapor change under global warming? Our results look like there's a lot more vapor transport to the high latitudes. The high latitudes become much more wet. And there's a possibility, though it's not clear yet, that the mid-latitudes, where we reside, probably become quite a bit drier.
You have been listening to Dr. Mark Pagani on Radio EcoShock. Mark, thank you for your work and your valuable time today.
No, thanks. Appreciate it.
Find a link to an abstract of Pagani's paper in my blog. The title is High Earth System Climate Sensitivity Determined from Pliocene Carbon Dioxide Concentrations. In addition to Mark Pagani, the authors are Zonghui Lui, Jonathan LaRiviere, and Anna Cristina Ravelo. It was published in the journal Nature Geoscience first online on December 20th, 2009. It isn't just climate scientists who say this. I'm going to take one more example, just one, from dozens and dozens. Back in 2006, Friday the 3rd of March to be exact, Dr. Jeremy Jackson delivered his Brave New Ocean speech. Jackson is a professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and a senior scientist at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. I have only a poor quality recording of this talk, taken from a video which you can still watch online. Find that link in my Radio EcoShock blog for February 25th, 2010. You must see it, or download the audio from the EcoShock Oceans page. Jackson says explicitly we are heading into a mass extinction event based on the dying state of our oceans. This is important for you to hear. We begin with the growing dead zones off the coast.
And then the degradation of water quality in coastal seas. This is something we can actually study from cores and via chemistry, so there's very hard data to support this. And so what you see is that all the things we valued in estuaries were the breadbasket, as it were, of humanity in the coastal zone. It's where all great civilizations arose. We've pretty much removed everything we valued in them, and we've created all this toxic stuff in them instead. And the result is the formation of more than 150 major dead zones around the world in coastal seas. Dead zones aren't dead. They're Precambrian, late Precambrian communities of microbes and jellyfish. And the only commercial harvest that can be sustained in dead zones is jellyfish. It's a major fishery, and they ship them to Taiwan. The hyperproduction in a dead zone is way beyond the ability of grazing animals to consume the phytoplankton, so they just die and rot. The breakdown of these microbes sucks up all the oxygen in the system, and so the water is anoxic all the way down from the very shallow surface area, and that's something to keep in mind.
That was Jeremy Jackson, and we'll be right back with more of that as he explains why the oceans are leaning towards a mass extinction event. And paleoclimatologist Peter Ward tells us how it could happen. Stay tuned for that. More Radio EcoShock.